Hey everyone, and welcome to this special soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. These soapbox editions are wholly sponsored. That means everyone you hear on these editions of the show paid to be here. And today we are chatting with a very special guest, Haroon Mir. Haroon is the founder of Thinks to Canary. Some call it a deception company, but he doesn't, as you'll hear. Haroon says Canary is a detection company and that is an important distinction. Now, if you don't know what canaries are, basically they're little honeypots that you put on the inside of your network. They're a little embedded device. You can get virtual canaries as well, but mostly they're little embedded devices. They take literally a couple of minutes to deploy. And when an attacker is moving laterally in your network, they will inevitably have a go at one of these things and you get an alert, which is a meaningful alert, right? Which is pretty simple concept. You can set them up to look like whatever you want. There's a whole bunch of profiles to choose from. And yeah, you can head to canary.tools/love to see canary customers singing their praises. Now, a lot of you will have heard Haroon's basic stump speech before. Canaries are easy to deploy, they give you reliable detection, high-quality signaling, etc., etc. And that's where this interview starts. But even if you've heard that part before, stick around, because I actually got Haroon to really tell the origin story of Canary, which is something he hasn't really spoken about before. We go all the way back to his SensePost days back in 2001, right through to him working for Actual Royalty in Doha, with a brief detour through him creating an anonymous whistleblower platform for a major broadcaster. You may have heard of Haroon and not really know why you've heard of Haroon, and this podcast explains why. Anyway, I started off by asking him why he resists the deception description for Canary's products, and here's what he had to say.
So we resisted it for multiple reasons. And besides just for marketing thing, part of our initial resistance was, like really the reason we exist is, can we detect stuff without pain on your network? And the first way that we thought about doing it happened to involve deception. And so you get people that are wholly focused on deception. And our whole thing has always been, can we do stuff that's painless to deploy, that lets you know when badness has happened? And it turns out that for that, honeypots slash deception have an interesting role to play. I think deception as a space, like it keeps popping up every now and then. Like Lance Spitzner and the team made it big news in the 2000s.
But we didn't really call it deception back then. And I'm glad you brought up Lance and you know, the honeypot project, which became the HoneyNet project. I mean, right. A lot of people listening to this, given how InfoSec or cyber security, as we now call it, given how quickly it's grown and how many new entrants there are into the industry, I mean, I'm guessing probably only about 10% of the listeners were around back in the days of Lance Spitzner doing his thing. But
you're calling me old.
I'm calling us old, okay? That's fine.
Yeah.
But I guess my point is that, you know, honeypots, as they were originally envisioned, they weren't things that you put on the inside of your networks. They were things that you put on the outside to see, see what would pop along. And of course, you never caught anything particularly interesting because attackers would break into them and go, this looks like a honeypot.
Yeah, I think, we mentioned before, I think Lance and them, and they did great work. In the early 2000s, I cut my teeth on those early know the enemy papers. Like it was super fascinating. Like you're going to learn about hackers. And even pre-Lance, there was early papers on an evening with a hacker, an evening with Beresford, which were about honeypots that captured actual attackers. And I think where that early crowd went off the rails slightly was they focused really on hacker anthropology. Like nobody knows this mysterious hacker. Download a honeypot, install it, and now you too can learn the secrets of the hacker. And of course, you didn't need a honeypot to learn that. And people with honeypots didn't learn that much anyway. Like they caught random scans that were blasting about the internet that they could have found any other way.
And that was the issue, right? Is back then there was plenty of O-Day, right? So if you wanted to catch someone interesting, you know, you would have to be O-Day'd, and no one was going to burn O-Day on something they wasn't sure was an interesting system. You know, so yeah. If you left a honeypot vulnerable to something dumb and known, it would be auto-hosed in about 10 seconds and you wouldn't get anything interesting. So the whole thing was going, like, it was a cool idea that just never quite played out.
Yeah, and famously, Silvio Goebbels took the HoneyNet project apart, like when they gave that famous DEF CON talk, Wolves Amongst Us. Like, one of the things they called out was, what, HoneyNet project, you've been running for years and you caught half of 1-0 day. Like, what's the point if you've never caught anything in the wild? And they were right. And so it went quiet for a bit. And then Symantec made Mantrap and a few players tried a product and it fizzled. And then it periodically has resurgences. And I think 2016, so a whole batch of investment, like a lot of money went into it. You're right. Like,
so
like
much, at least, man.
Four or five companies raised like $60 million to build this stuff.
And some and of them us, are no longer with us, we should point out, right? Because there's been new market entrants, and some of them obviously spurred on by the success that you've had. And they raised a bunch of money, went to market, and it landed like a wet fart, to be honest.
Yeah. Yes. They certainly fizzled. And I think the biggest mistake that those people make compared to us, and I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding here in terms of what companies can spend their time on. And currently, most of the reception people that I've seen are really complicated. Like their pitch is really, you now need a team of people who spend time doing this deception stuff. And essentially what you need is a counter-surveillance team or counter-espionage team, because now what you've got is people understanding the attackers and building these traps for them and trying to deeply understand them. And I think the big misunderstanding, there's a part of it that's vanity on the side of people building products who really think that the customer is all about them. And so you're building this product that you now need new staff and people to engineer up on. And actually, people don't exist to play your deception games. Like all these customers want to do their business.
They want to save time, right? Like, that's the one thing. They want to save time and money. That is the one thing that will sell. Right. And, you know, I mean, I deal with so many vendors, so many startups, right, who come in through snake oilers and stuff. And the ones who just have astronomical responses are the ones who've created a solution that delivers a good security outcome and saves time and money. You do those things, you have a license to print money.
It's super interesting because it's like we've seen it. And even if you start off with that simple premise, when you're running a company, like we've noticed, you get inside your own head and you live in your own head and you start solving your own problems. And so you start adding things to the product that are cool for you, but add work for the customer. And so you very quickly forget that you exist to make it easy for them. And so it's jumping ahead, but a really good example is we just spent a ridiculous amount of time effectively with our first big visual upgrade to the console. So the console's been running. The console is where Canaries report into. And we spent like an embarrassing amount of time on it, like more than a year on it. And part of the reason we took so long is because it was really easy to do an upgrade. Like, we did a whole bunch of new stuff. And then when you stop and you think about it and you listen to users, users were really happy with the version that they had. They loved how simple it was. And then what? Because we felt it was cool, we're going to change their world to give them a new thing. Like, they didn't ask for the new thing. Like, the new thing has to be so significantly better because you're literally changing the way they work. And people see this just as a natural part of development, is you build a thing and then you build version two and you keep upgrading it. And it almost sounds lazy not to. But part of the thing, again, is if you think about the customer, the customer didn't ask for that change.
Yeah, I mean, innovation, features aren't innovation necessarily, right?
It's super interesting. And we had a big, so as a complete aside, like we use FreshBooks for our accounting. And we got an email in the middle of all our work. Like, we'd spent a year working on our upgrade. And we got an email from FreshBooks saying, hey, good news, it's time to upgrade to FreshBooks new something something. And Anna, who runs our back office stuff, literally mailed me with the, oh no, !! Literally, someone like a team at FreshBooks worked forever to build this update.
That was going to break all of your processes.
Yeah, and our reaction to it was, oh no, this is the worst thing ever. And it genuinely made us go back to the drawing board and go like, hold on, like are people going to say this to our upgrade? Because, and you obviously don't want to stagnate. There's new features to add. But that thing of going back to, are we making it easier for the customer, or does this make it easier for us? Is this a cool sounding feature for us? Like, everyone takes flack or everyone gives Apple flack for it. But if you see Apple's design process, a lot of what they do is just editing. It's just deciding, actually, this doesn't make the cut. Like, actually, this feature is not good enough to teach people a new habit.
You know the saying, I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have time.
It's that stuff's exactly right. And it's very interesting because as a small company, when we started off, like we got, I often say we got lucky because early on, like early on when you're saying that sort of stuff, you could just be saying it because you couldn't really build 300 features. So you're telling people, hey, you wrote this short letter because you're too small to write a big letter. And so early on when we had this approach, it was questionable. Like, are these just five monkeys in a garage and that's why they haven't built more features and built this into a bigger product? And as we grow, we actually have to consciously work to make sure we don't just give in to that trap of just adding features or just adding stuff. Because just like short letter, long letter, it's shockingly easy to just add features.
Well, let me just cut you off there because there is one area where you have added features, right? So initially, and of course, the secret sauce in what you've done and the success that you've had is you took this idea of a honeypot, which, you know, to an attacker, you're running across a honeypot on the internet, just sitting there, it looks maybe a little bit sus. But, you know, you decided that you could put honeypots where they really do belong. In retrospect, it makes so much sense that you put them on the inside, right? Because there's so much random cruft on the inside, they don't actually stick out. And they could be a valuable target depending on what you've, prettied them up to look like, right? They might be a backup system. It might be a, you know, SMB server, whatever it is you can select from the profiles. You know, so that was really what you did and, you know, the basis for your success. But then you've come up with canary tokens, right? Which are all of these... you know, tokens you can put in Word documents or, you know, DNS-based tokens, you know, domain name-based tokens and all this sort of stuff. And you built the back-end infrastructure. That's free. People can go to canarytokens.org and actually generate these things for free. But then you incorporated that into the console. And that, that was cool, right? Because for your existing customers who already had the hardware stuff, they all of a sudden are in a position where, because they're already your customer, all of a sudden they can go start actually seeding these things around and actually get some meaningful use out of them. Yeah,
it's so tokens were interesting, and tokens remain an interesting space. Tokens go where canaries can't. And it's interesting because, like, in a SaaS world, you can't easily drop a honeypot. Like, if somebody is using Salesforce and a whole bunch of SaaS products, like, how do you tripwire that stuff? And tokens now allow you to tripwire that stuff. And tokens remain for our customers the easiest way to financially abuse us, because, like you say, we give it away free even to them. And so we've got single customers with 30,000 tokens. And doesn't cost them anything. So they just spread them around. And we totally encourage it. It's like done cleverly, tokens are incredibly high value. And again, for us, it comes down to, and it speaks to the original question that says, are tokens deception? I don't know. But what we know is they're easy.
Look, I hear where you're going. Signal. This is a theme that's popped up twice, and we're only like 10 minutes into this, which is that it's not deception, it's detection.
Correct. It's what's high value detection that's zero effort. And even with the honeypots, a thing that I'll always say, I think we were lucky with early because like you start with a few insights, but it's not like light bulb moment. This is it. Like we thought, okay, like easy to deploy honeypots would be cool. But we really doubled down a lot on making it easy, to the point where, like, even now we're pretty fanatical about shaving seconds, not off response times, but off friction to deploy canaries. So like, we had this thing initially where we'd say you can deploy a canary in 3 minutes, and we've now even got back-end processes so that we pre-enroll canaries for customers.
So all they need to do is plug them in. Yeah.
And the key insight for us there, and I think this is a bit of a security market hack, and it speaks a little badly about the security community, but about the state that we're in. And that is, like everyone's got great products, or there's some great products that work if you jump through all the hoops and do everything. Like if you've ever sat through a DLP pitch, it totally makes sense. Like, yes, if we just tag all our data, we totally know everything we need to. Except I've not seen a single successful DLP project ever, because unless you're in military. Because the act of actually classifying all your data and then tagging all your data is so ridiculously onerous that it never gets done right. And the same with, I've seen so many SIEM products that pitch perfectly, but then carry on for years and years as people have to get that stuff right. And our whole pitch remains, while you're doing all those projects, which you totally should do because they're good ends to reach, get 20 canaries and drop them now. Like, it's going to take you 30 minutes.
It's funny you mentioned SIEMs, because I think the last sponsored interview I did, it wasn't with you, I think it was with Marco maybe, and he was talking about how you guys have to actually generate a whole bunch of alerts. Because normally, I mean, the best thing about Canary is it sends one alert and you know you've got a problem, right? Chances are, It's entirely possible you could have a false positive. It could be some automated bit of software that's tripped it or whatever, or a vuln scanner. But chances are, at the very least, it's something you want to investigate, right? So you can pump alerts through your API into SIEM consoles. But some of these SIEM consoles, they actually have an alert threshold before they will display the alerts to the user. So you actually have to generate false alerts to get your single alert seen by a SIEM operator.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. It's the state of SIEMs, and I know there's a few people working on it, and I'm sure they'll do better.
There is some good SIEM tech out there, but basically it's all Splunk and ArcSight right now, and most of it sucks.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting space for people to go. I think it's in Gartner's trough of disillusionment right now. Like I think there were huge promises that said SIEM all the things, collect all the things, and people went on those projects, and now are going, like, when does this add value?
They're saying, why are we giving $2 million a month to Splunk?
To Splunk, yeah. And again, my main pitch there, and we integrate with all of these SIEMs, and we actually have just done a bunch of work to make some of that integration easier. But again, our whole pitch is totally go do those things. But spend $20,000 and 2 hours and actually do this first. And it's interesting because it fundamentally also makes a big difference with where we end up positioning with the other deception players. Like, with the other deception players, there's a valid argument that says, look, let us get all these basics right, and then we'll worry about this grand spy versus spy stuff. And that's a fair argument. Like people who don't know anything about their network, and people who've, like, go sort that stuff out. Like, you're getting taken out by random script kiddies. You don't have time to play spy versus spy with deception stuff. And where canaries are different is, if they genuinely only going to take you half an hour to deploy and are genuinely going to give you so few false positives, actually we pitch it as, this is the first thing you should do. Like literally, you just land at a new company and you don't know anything about the network. Drop 20 canaries down.
Yeah, and see if they start chirping. But I mean, even if you do have a SIEM, if you've spent megabucks on your SIEM, and they're expensive projects. I mean, I hear the numbers bandied about, by CISOs I know, and I'm like, you're spending how much? Whereas if you could get a bunch of canaries, the thing that I like about them, right, is because it's possible to miss stuff in seams. There's a lot of companies now doing some pretty good automation, right? So a lot of that level one analysis has sort of gone away, right? And that's all been machine learning away. But what I like about canaries is, say you've got your, you know, multi-million dollar SOC, but you've got just too much crap to deal with. Canaries give you a peace of mind, right? Because if one of those things chirps and you do have the seam, guess what? Happy days, you've got all of the data there and the tools that you need to slice and dice and figure out what set off the alert. But the fact is, you know, you can prioritize that work because you got a canary.
Yeah, it's exactly that. And the two places we see that pop up a lot with really mature customers is we've just done an acquisition. So we've just done an acquisition. We're about to take on this whole network that we've never seen before.
And that's actually how a lot of those major breaches happen, man. Like that's
it's exactly that. It's there's now this whole addition to the network. Let's just drop some canaries in there. And the other thing that we've seen shockingly a lot is misconfigurations that weren't expected. And so you'd see a canary get lit up that's just been silent forever. And you go like, wait, what happened there? And like now we've got a customer success team, which has really grown up, who'll talk to the customer and go like, hey, and you'd end up hearing a bunch of times, the customer goes, no, there was a misconfiguration on this firewall. And suddenly this part of the network got exposed.
I gotta tell you a story at this point, right? Which is like back when Risky Biz was a baby podcast, it was very cheap to sponsor it because, you know, obviously it didn't have the listener base that it has now. Sure. But Checkpoint, the like local Australia Checkpoint guy, arranged to sponsor it, one of the tech guys at Checkpoint, so that he could come on and do these sponsor interviews to basically remind people to like maybe remove the allow any firewall rules they'd put in their Checkpoint gear because they were having trouble one day and they just figured that was the easy. And this is before we had pointy clicky like Palo Alto style firewalls. But you're right. I mean, they were literally sponsoring this podcast just so they could get on mic and say, go check for an allow any. It was that much of an issue. And it still is.
So I think there's a super interesting thing that's buried in there. That's like I'm half formulating it as I speak, but like it actually speaks to why canaries have some measure of success also. And that is, there's the InfoSec world that we want to live in, which in our heads, everything is segmented and everything's least privilege. And part of the problem that InfoSec has as a discipline is everyone knows that part. So like if you talk to someone, everyone knows least privilege and everyone knows segregation, and everyone acts like the network is not a complete dog show with flat networks and mixed permissions. And we do this so consistently that it's interesting because you then see that everybody wants complex solutions because in your head, it's got to beat this complex, everything works, everything segregated, separation of privilege. But in reality, actually what your network needed was some duo. Actually what your network needed was some simple BEC protection. You needed simple alerting. And there's this problem where InfoSec is not honest with itself about the actual state of things. And so when you talk
now,
about-
Now you're speaking as someone, you know, and this, the people who I hear say exactly the same thing, you know, who says exactly what you say? Adam Boileau, right? Spends all his days all up in everybody's business as a red teamer, right? And he gets in there and he's just like, I mean, he's borderline traumatized by what he sees at these multi-billion dollar companies. This is a good point though, to actually go back and talk a little bit about your history, because I think it's interesting and people know your name, right? Like you're a well-known person in security, but people don't maybe know why. And I think it's, I think it's worth pointing out just a bit of the history here. Why don't we go back? Let's go all the way back to SensePost, right? Because SensePost in South Africa, and I mean, we're talking what, like early to mid 2000s?
2001.
Yeah, okay, so 2001 and then sort of peaking a few years after that. This is one of the early pen testing firms out of South Africa. I believe you weren't a co-founder, but you were a very early employee.
Yeah, so I was literally person number one. Yeah. And so I became a director. Like the first time we hired someone who was not me, I became a director, so that person became employee number one. And so everybody thought I was a founder, but no, I was actually employee number one at SensePost.
But let's just talk about what SensePost was, because SensePost back then was the South African security company, right? Yeah. Like it was the company and globally recognized for its very high quality research. I mean, one of the founders, the two founders I know, it was Charles van der Walt, right? Who is still running what was SensePost, but he's now, I think, part of Orange. Is that right? Yeah, yeah. So there's been a bunch of acquisitions and whatever. The other founder was Roelof Temming, right? Who later went on to create Multigo and is now working on a browser extension called Vortimo that honestly, I sent a tweet the other day saying this is going to be huge. It's in beta. It's being launched next year and it is amazing. Have you fiddled with it?
I've played with it. It's cool.
It is very cool.
It's so Roelof. It's and SensePost was cool for that. And look, like most things, we got a little bit lucky. And with SensePost, we got lucky in a bunch of ways. So
hang on. Why don't we just start at the beginning? You know, I mean, what was SensePost really? I mean, SensePost was a pen testing company before pen testing companies were really a thing, essentially, right?
Right. So there were six of us, and literally what we did was pen test companies. And one of the early places we got lucky was we were separated enough from the rest of the world that we didn't start off doing our pen testing the way everyone else did. And one of the big differences really early on was we spent a lot of time footprinting customers. And so where the rest of the world had this problem with, like, when we first started showing up at Black Hat and DEF CON, we'd hear about customers who just tell you to pen test one IP. So all these networks that were paying for security audits but weren't actually understanding their security posture because they were giving you a limited scope. And for us, that was just crazy pants. Like a customer says, here's money, break into my network. And we used to go till we could read the CEO's email or show him his mail spools.
I mean, what's funny, right, is right now people are listening to this going, oh, pen testing, so what? Red teaming, so what? This was 20 years ago, right? Like this was pretty radical stuff back then, right? And not many security firms really had the trust to get engagements like this.
It was pretty cool. And we were based in South Africa, but most of our work was done in the US and in Europe. And then super early on, we got lucky because we did talks at SummerCon and then at Black Hat. And those talks gave us exposure in the US and Europe. And so we ended up doing really nice customers. So lots of the big vendors, lots of really nice name customers. And we were literally just 25-year-olds, 30-year-olds, like behaving like school kids. Like literally just loving being on these networks, owning them and reading customer mails. And it was incredible fun, like incredible fun, incredible rush. And in part because we were making lots of that stuff up as we were going along.
And that's what I mean. And that's what it might be hard for some people listening to this to know, you know, quite how, you know, yeah, just quite how improvised the whole thing was back then, right? You know, I think SensePost was one of the companies that was one of the most successful improvisational security companies.
Yeah, and it was cool. Like we ended up making a nice name for ourselves. And mainly that came from, like in the company, we had a really strong sense of pushing boundaries. Like you see it in the direction Roelof's gone, you see it in the stuff that we do. There's a genuine ants in the pantsness for we can do this a little better.
Okay, so this is where I want to introduce something, which is, I mean, one of the reasons I brought it up. Charles has to his credit built SensePost into a terrific professional services organization that I think has now been acquired twice upwards, right? And is now part of Orange. So there was, you know, they were terribly successful in that. But I remember asking Roelof, you know, why did you get out of professional services? Why did you get out of SensePost? Because he actually wound up leaving before the first acquisition. And he said, because I wanted to do cool shit. you know? And this was an interesting thing. I mean, he was kind of sick of that pen testing stuff all the way back then, and then went off and created Multigo, which, you know, I'm guessing a lot of people listening to this would know about Multigo. This was, of course, your colleague. And then, of course, now he's doing Vortimo. And you've gone off and you did a whole bunch of interesting stuff before Thinkst Canary as well, didn't you?
Right. Yeah, it the doing cool stuff is really interesting, especially if you're at a good pen testing company, because you can very easily get fooled into thinking that you are. And I say this with no insult to my pen test red team brethren. Like there's a lot of cool stuff that can be done there. But you get to a point where the stuff starts to be very familiar. Like you breaking into stuff, you then projecting yourself into the network, you doing cool stuff in there.
It becomes a little bit like mowing the lawn, right?
Yeah, it does, but it's really deceptive because you're doing cool stuff and getting your dopamine hit on every engagement. Like unless your company is signing up for really lame constant PCI audits, you can do cool stuff on every engagement. Because on every engagement, you've got to find that way in, you've got to tunnel your way in, you've got to maybe build some tools. And like I say, at SensePost, we worked hard. Like Ruloff and I specifically, even as the company was growing, we kind of ended up creating positions in the company where we only got to work on really nice parts of the problem. And we managed to build a business model of it, so that you'd be encouraging young people to do more of that. You do more of that. The company gets known for that. So you only get high-end engagements. Like in some ways, it was living the pen test dream. Like we'd not take work that was boring and we could do it. But with all of that, like for my personal thing, at some point I said, you know what? Like we constantly drawing in the margins of other people's work. Like somebody's written this book and we may draw what we think is a masterpiece in the margin, but actually it's just a drawing in the margin. And there's cooler, like how about if we can actually make stuff and see where that stuff goes? Like I've done a few talks trying to encourage pen testers to branch out, mainly because I actually believe that it sucks up some really quality thinkers. Like we've got people who are really excellent at spotting a problem, honing in on a problem, and building a fix for it, who are now just doing this for a living. Baz Alberts has this post when he was leaving ImmunitySec, where he says, basically, pen testing is like Dave's built this place where he keeps giving you nice puzzles for people who are addicted to solving puzzles. And that's what happens, right? Like you get a pen test company and they just give you a new puzzle every month. And for someone who likes the dopamine hit of solving puzzles, that's awesome. You just solve new puzzles all the time. But what's interesting is in the market, there are puzzles waiting to be solved that the market will pay you for and that the market desperately needs.
Yeah.
Like if you just re-aim and make that the problem that needs solving.
Well, tell us about how you re-aimed, right? Because you actually had a pretty interesting path between, okay, so we've talked about the SensePost thing. I'm sorry this has turned into right. This is your life, by the way, Arun, but it cool. is, you know, I mean, look, for those of you who are listening, I mean, you could probably guess that, you know, Arun and I are friends. Right. And I'm friends also with Ruloff and I'm friends also with Charles. Like I love these guys. And I just think their history is really interesting, which is why I'm bothering to draw it out in a podcast. But you didn't just go straight from SensePost into Thinkst Canary. Thinkst had a previous incarnation, really. Tell us right. about that.
So it's actually interesting because leaving Thinkst, I knew that I wanted to try to build a product company. My earlier hope was actually slightly more ambitious than that. I wanted multiple products. Like I had this vision of you'll just build things and then spin them off and they'll go become companies on their own. And one of the things you figure out there is that everything you build actually takes a whole bunch of effort to get it to market. I didn't know the product that we wanted to build yet. So when Ruloff left SensePost, Ruloff already had an early version of Multigo. And so he went, iterated on that and made it better and better and better. And when I left, I had like four or five ideas. One of them was a WEF, believe it or not. One of them was like, how can we detect badness on this thing? One of them was solving remote password resets, as lame as that sounds. I was like, well, this is an unsolved problem. And I had a short list of them. And my plan was to find customers who'd pay me to solve that problem for them, with the understanding that I could then resell that as a product. And so instead of raising money, I said, I'd go to a customer and say, hey, this is a big problem for you. Pay me to build it for you. And after I build it for them, I'd sell it to other people. And so we tried a few problems. And then there's a diversion in the road, because one of the first customers that I actually did stuff like this for, I built a version of WikiLeaks for Al Jazeera way earlier.
I'm really surprised that you actually named them, because I was prepared to ask you a question about the work you did for a broadcaster, because this is not something you've really spoken about publicly before, is it?
No, I haven't. And not for a huge secret, but just because like generally customer names are just not worth.
But you did a lot of work for Al Jazeera for quite a while.
I did.
Yeah. And you were interfacing with very senior people in that organization.
Yes. So what happened was it started with a friend of mine who worked there said that they needed, or they were interested in, a WikiLeaks program. And this was way early, when WikiLeaks was the darling of journalism. So you're talking about...
This is when WikiLeaks was cool.
Yeah. WikiLeaks was cool and all the journalists wanted them. And already Al Jazeera was saying they wanted their own platform where people could leak stuff to them. So I spoke to them a little bit, and we actually built a really cool thing for them. Like considering when it was, it tells you its age, it was a Java applet that loads on the client machine with natively Tor and natively PGP, with the logic that the stuff you want to leak never leaves your machine without being encrypted with a key that's never shown on the internet. So on your machine, it gets encrypted. And by the time it reaches the server, it's natively Tored. So the server doesn't know who sent it. You can just pull that stuff off the server and PGP decrypt it later.
And what year was this?
This was 2010, late 2010.
Yeah.
So it was super cool, and they ran it for a bit. And while I was doing it, the whole Egypt revolution happened. And I was literally at Al Jazeera when Egypt fell. And Al Jazeera got taken off the air. And at the time, what I figured out just by accident, by being there, was that they thought that security meant having a firewall. And here was this org that was covering what was becoming the Arab Spring. But literally, they had zero real understanding of security, everything you can think of, flat network. And also, it's such an interesting business model, right? Like everybody hits at journalists, but journalists literally have, some journalists have all the interests of full-blown spies, except they publish everything, and actually wrapping them up in cotton wool isn't the solution, because putting stuff out there is what they do. So I ended up speaking to the director general at the time, and I proposed a bunch of products that I said we could build for them, again, with the view to these would be great products outside. And we agreed on a contract where we could build a bunch of things, like how would you know you were owned? If you were a journalist, how would you know that your devices were owned? Stuff like that. And the interesting thing is, he said, look, you can do this as long as you come over here to Doha and work on it here. And at the time, it was just my wife and I, and we said, okay, let's go do a Doha holiday and see how that works. It turned out to be super interesting. And when I got there, I saw the breadth of their problems. And they then went through management changes, like a new director general came in who turned out to be royalty, and he was more interested in locking stuff down. And at that point, I said to them, hey, listen, here's these projects that we're doing for you, but I'll leave. And he said, look, can you build out our security team? And so essentially what I did at that point, and at that point, things was just me. So I had the ability to, and I said, okay, hired their team, built their team up. And something that's not spoken about in the Canary origin story is after I built that team and left them, like I'd still periodically not so much consult for them as like give advice to some of their executives, like the head of their new media division or the head of their technology division. And with Canary, I pitched the idea to them of dropping honeypots as a way to get insight into their new satellite networks. And they didn't implement it. Normally, they used to do everything I'd say, and they didn't over two visits. And that's when we started to figure, well, hold on, these people want to do it. They're just not getting around to doing it.
We need to make it easy.
The problem that needs solving is making this thing so easy that people who want to will do it. The time CISOing them was super interesting because it gives you an interesting view again into the, like I was coming off 10 years of ridiculously convoluted hacks at SensePost, right? Because in the position I ended up in, like I just get involved when it were cool hacks or cool customers. And so you end up with these really cool technical problems. And now you walk in and actually your problem is
solving
your journalists.
Them.
Journalists in Morocco are sharing passwords.
Yes. Your problem is red teamer, old school red teamer, welcome to the real world. I mean, have you ever told the origin story in this way before?
No.
It's cool. It's a cool story, right? You see why I wanted you to tell it.
I buy it. It's interesting. And certainly it gave an interesting awareness of the problems that need solving and some of the real worldness. It's why we laugh when you hear someone saying they just need to do this. Like, why didn't they just solve this? It's like, yes, because they've got a million political battles to fight internally to solve that. Is that the fight they're going to take up now? And so to almost go full circle, it's why we bother shaving off all the Canary friction. And as a company, we do stupid lengths around it, not just technically, but like for everything, like the order process, the buying process, our legals process. Because in large part of what we learned there from the battles that security is actually fighting, Like they've got all these battles and sometimes just your payment process trips them up and doesn't let your product go in. And so we shave, like if there's one thing we spend crazy amount of time on now, it's shaving off friction in every interaction with us as a company.
So it's funny, right? Because I think people can infer from what you've just said, that royalty actually had a hand in the development of Canary.
Yes, I think at the end of the day, we all love to serve. It was certainly interesting.
Well, Haroon Mir, thank you so much. This is the first soapbox we've ever done. You've been a good friend and a supporter of this program and have certainly helped me over the years. And it was last year when I said, I really think you should come on and do one of these soapbox editions because, you're a bloody interesting guy. And I'm glad you've been able to tell this story and talk about the stuff that you've done. I mean, it's great to do some marketing and stuff, but it's also really cool to talk about your history, where you came from, the origin story for Canary. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you, and I hope we get to do it again soon.
It's been awesome. Thanks so much, Ben.
That was Haroon Mir there with a chat about, a whole bunch of stuff, really. And you can check out Canary at canary.tools. And you can check out what their customers say at canary.tools/love. And that is it for this edition of The Soapbox. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with another edition of The Weekly Show. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.